Welcome to the University of Michigan Press podcast. We're speaking with Michael Lewis Beck, co-author of The American Voter Revisited, an in-depth look at voter behavior and political psychology. The American Voter Revisited recreates the landmark book of 1960, The American Voter, which was based on the presidential elections of 1952 and 1956. The new book follows the same format, theory, and mode of analysis as the original, and tests the ideas and methods of the 1960 text against presidential election surveys from 2000 and 2004. Surprisingly, The American Voter Revisited finds that voter behavior has been remarkably consistent over the last half century, and that the contemporary American voter behaves politically much like voters of the 1950s. Why was the original book written? Was there something unique or special about the 1952 and 1956 elections?
Well, The American Voter, that's the book, by now the written by the now renowned team of Campbell, Converse, Miller, and Stokes, came out of a growing dissatisfaction with how elections were analyzed by pundits and scholars. Discussions in the media would use only anecdotes, stories, or tidbits of facts to explain why people voted the way they did. In other words, there was a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking. Scholars would look simply at patterns of election returns that the states reported, or descriptive accounts given by politicians. So it was all guesswork. And in other words, no one really knew anything about what individual voters thought and did. They just speculated. So the big breakthrough with The American Voter was that they actually looked systematically at real voters and in more than one election. With respect to the 1952 and 56 elections, what's unique about them is it's the surveys that were done in those years were the first massive scientific public opinion surveys of individual American voters to become available. And these surveys were the fodder for this seminal study.
All right. So if that represents the history of the original, what then was your motivation or inspiration for writing The American Voter Revisited?
We wanted to see if The American Voter itself stood the test of time. After all, it's based on elections that are over 50 years old, and perhaps the conclusions were completely old-fashioned. We wanted to find out whether that was so.
Okay, and so what did you find out? What did you discover as you researched and wrote your book?
Well, the American Voter, the original American Voter, had a profound impact on scholars, pundits, politicians, ordinary students of American elections. It became the accepted way of thinking about how citizens actually behave politically. But recently there's been a growing worry that what it discovered was no longer true. After all, it came out in 1960, so at first blush, the obvious reaction is it's out of date, it no longer is relevant. We wanted to see if, in fact, its theories and conclusions still held up once you applied them to current elections. The authors, Campbell, Converse, Miller, and Stokes, sometimes known as the Four Horsemen, put forward a novel idea of a funnel of causality, which is this, that the act of voting is at the tip of the funnel, and it's finally determined by a series of prior social and psychological steps. For example, social background and especially a party identification, do they still largely shape political attitudes and perceptions that lead to the vote? Furthermore, are voters still mostly inattentive to politics with a very low level of interest in politics, very little understanding of the liberal conservative debate that's raging in the media? The answer to these questions, perhaps surprisingly, is yes. In other words, the typical American voter today pretty much follows the same cues as he or she did 50 years ago.
That's really interesting. So any guesses as to why the American voter hasn't changed in 50 years? Do you think it says more about human nature or about our particular political system?
I think it says something about both. With regard to human nature, it is true that in most democracies, most of the time, the average citizens don't pay a lot of attention to politics. They have other things to do. So Americans are no different there. Now, it does say something about the political system in that not all political systems have as low level of attention to politics as we do. For example, the French system, which is one that I've spent a lot of time studying, the level of attention and ideological awareness is a lot higher. Now that's not necessarily a condemnation of the U.S. system or a praise of the French system. I mean, some people argue that when interest levels are fairly low, that's a sign of political contentment. So, you know, just saying the fact that people don't in their normal lives pay a lot of attention to politics is not necessarily saying that the American voter is not intelligent. It's just saying that they have other things to do with their time.
Okay. So how does your approach differ from the American voter?
The key difference is that it employs contemporary presidential elections, the 2000 and 2004 elections, instead of relying on the 52 and 56 elections, which the original book did. And this is important for several reasons. First, students these days barely even know who the candidates in 52 and 56, Adlai Stevenson and Dwight Eisenhower, were.
Yes.
For another reason, it's plausible that how voters behave now has dramatically changed. And if this is so, it needs to be documented. And in that context, it seemed important to us to follow, to the extent possible, the original research procedures of Campbell, Converse, Miller, and Stokes. By that means, a clear answer could be arrived at. We could say one way or another, if voters were different, then to now. And as I mentioned above, they are remarkably the same.
Okay. So why then is voting behavior of interest?
Voting behavior is about what people do, not what they should do or what they might do.
Okay.
It's that behavior that elects presidential candidates or defeats them. Collectively, it's probably the most important political act in the country. Thus, how individuals do actually vote and why they do, it's the research focus of this book. For example, we would not ask if someone should vote for George Bush or not. That's a question of their personal values. Instead, we would ask, given you vote for George Bush, why did you do it?
Mm-hmm.
With questions such as these, we can begin to sort out what moves voters and why some candidates win, some lose.
Okay. So tell us how information was gathered for your book.
The information, or data, if you will, for the book came from scientific national samples of the American electorate for the presidential elections of 2000 and 2004. These public opinion polls, conducted by the National Election Study out of the University of Michigan, are the premier source of information available about the individual American voter.
Okay, so what are the National Election Studies, and what part do they play in both the original and this book?
The National Election Studies systematically interview, face-to-face, about 1,500 voters before and after each election. Each interview lasts an hour or more and contains an extensive set of questions about political attitudes, issues and behaviors, socioeconomic background. There are many election polls in this country these days, but the NES, as they call it, serves as the flagship. The NES surveys offered a revolutionary way of studying voters. Never before had individuals been systematically examined in the way that they provided. They began in 1948 and really got underway in 52 and 56, and it's the 52 and 56 surveys that form the core of the original American voter. And in our book, we draw a conscious parallel, selecting the two most current NES studies available. That's the presidential elections of 2000 and 2004.
So how does the NES arrive at a sample of the national electorate then?
The NES draws a probability sample of the entire American electorate, usually of about 1,500 respondents. Since selections based on principles of randomness, it is representative of all American voters. In other words, it is effectively a microcosm of them. That's why, even though they only speak to about 1,500 voters, they can make statements about all American voters. An almost unique feature here these days of the NES is that the interviews are face-to-face. That is, they're in-home, talking to individuals in private, as opposed to a telephone interview. This makes them very valuable in themselves.
It would almost seem that a telephone would be easier for people to speak more freely. Why do you think our face-to-face interview is better than telephone?
Well, there's several reasons. One reason is that you can't keep people on the telephone very long. You can keep them 5 minutes, maybe 10 if you're lucky. These face-to-face interviews, you can get a person talking for over an hour, and in that hour you can cover lots of material in depth that you can't begin to cover in a telephone interview. So they're really a unique, almost anthropological source of how Americans think about politics.
you write that you're more interested in understanding the processes that lead to voting behavior rather than predicting that behavior. Why is that?
Well, we're most interested in understanding why voters act the way they do. When you can answer the question, why do voters pick candidate X over candidate Y, you can solve a lot of disagreements. For example, why in 2004 did voters select George Bush over John Kerry? There was a lot of speculation in the press about that question. In our book, we show a number of reasons why this occurred and rule out some reasons that don't hold up. For instance, voters saw Kerry as an indecisive person and Bush as trustworthy. Also, they saw the economy as improving, and that stuck. That benefited the president. Further, the Democrats were less loyal to Kerry than Republicans were to Bush. Now, these are just some of the findings in the books. Such results as these and others move us well down the road in terms of explaining voting behavior generally. Now, about your question regarding prediction, we aren't saying prediction is not important. It is important. In fact, we demonstrate that knowing a voter's set of political attitudes prior to an election, we can predict the vote rather accurately. Unfortunately, for the prediction of the overall election outcome, these measures of individual attitudes that could be summed up for this are not available until after the election takes place.
Okay. Well, one point you make is very interesting, that the party with a group image problem is the Republican Party. Can you explain and expand on that a little bit?
Sure. There are certain groups in our society that are more reliably Democratic than Republican. Among them, labor groups, blacks, low-income voters, Jews, urban dwellers. In other words, the historical New Deal coalition that was formed after Franklin Roosevelt became president. Now, this coalition's changing somewhat. For example, it's gaining women and Hispanics. The Republicans have had a difficult time attracting these groups. However, they are making some inroads into the New Deal coalition, as it's called, for example, with Southern whites and Catholics. Indeed, our analysis shows that Catholics, which used to be solidly Democrat, are no longer so.
That's very interesting. So it almost seems as if another The American Voter Revisited would be a good idea after the 2008 election, in that the next election might be a watershed event.
Well, it's certainly always good to keep things fresh by incorporating new information, such as the 2008 election will certainly provide. Now, will it be a watershed event? Well, clearly there are new candidate faces on both the Republican and Democratic sides. The Iraq War, which was a major issue in 2004, still persists today. The economy is also at the top of the agenda. And the American electorate is somewhat more ideological than it used to be. But the question is, do these things add up to a watershed? Commonly, in any presidential election, there's a challenge of change. I mean, look at the special dramas that took place in 2000 and then in 2004. While 2008 will not be like them, it can be expected to have its own share of compelling issues. The key question for us, then, is how the American voter responds to these issues. Do they rely on the same signals, the same cues, the same thought processes, the same underlying set of preferences, or not? My guess is that they will respond in ways very similar to ways that they always have.
So expanding on that answer then, what does the American Voter Revisited tell us about the upcoming 2008 election?
Well, the 2008 outcome will be faced by long-term and short-term forces. First, let's look at the long-term forces. At the end of the campaign, which we're in the midst of, well, we're moving toward now at least, American voters at the end of a campaign return to their party identification for guidance. Almost always, they vote for the candidate of the party that they feel attached to. It's important to emphasize this point. Someone who says they are a Democrat will almost invariably vote for the Democratic candidate. Likewise, a Republican who says they're a Republican will almost always vote for the Republican candidate. This doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room then. There are, in fact, some true independents in the electorate, but they're only around 10% of the voters. And another point is, besides political party identification, enduring group attachments, which we alluded to above, count for a lot. For example, blacks, Jews, Hispanics, women, and labor union members are clearly more likely to vote Democratic. Southern white males and evangelicals are clearly more likely to vote Republican. Now, with respect to short-term forces, there are various issues and candidate leadership characteristics which come into play. The two leading issues, war and the economy, will both be on the agenda in 2008. What we have shown is that Republicans have lost their traditional edge on the war issue. With respect to the economy, the party in the White House, the Republican Party in this case, will be punished for bad economic times. On other issues, such as health care or the environment, these issues will only have limited play because, as we've demonstrated, most American voters do not tend to such issues, and when they do, they have difficulty differentiating the candidates on them. Finally, with respect to candidate characteristics, decisiveness, or at least the perception of decisiveness and the perception of honesty are especially important candidate characteristics. Now, just one last thing. This bundle of forces doesn't compose a crystal ball, enabling us to foretell without error who's going to win. But it does show us that for the individual voter, there are clear reasons that can be pointed to for his or her choice. These reasons have to do with the voter's perceived interest in the short run and the long run. In other words, they're not merely passive spectators of a popularity contest with shallow or fickle opinions based on personality or appearance or what the latest talking head is saying. That is, they're certainly not fools, as the authors of the original American Voter pointed out, and our work continues to demonstrate.
Okay. So, Michael, then finally, then, how do you see the American Voter Revisited's place in the canon of books on American politics?
Well, the original, the American Voter, was unique. It changed the way political scientists thought about how people voted and spawned literally thousands of books and articles. One can say without hesitation that it is the most widely cited book in the discipline. Beyond that monumental influence, it reached, as few academic books have, the hearts and minds of many politicians and pundits. There are a handful of scholarly political science books that this group knows. This is one of them. We, of course, do not expect to attain that level of recognition. However, our book, The American Voter Revisited, largely vindicates the findings and interpretations of the American Voter itself. Thus, we think it deserves a place next to it on the canonical bookshelf.
Okay. Michael Lewis Beck, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Michael Lewis Beck, co-author with William Jacoby, Helmut Norpoth, and Herbert Weisberg of The American Voter Revisited, published by the University of Michigan Press. If you'd like to learn more about our other books, please visit us on the web at press.umich.edu. This podcast has been brought to you by the University of Michigan Press. Copyright 2008. All rights reserved.